Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly with Jeff Fawcett, PhD, and we offer a critical independent voice on the politics and practice of health. We know it's quiet when we hear the sounds of nature around us, the blowing of trees, the sounds of birds, water. But humans mold the environment and fill the quiet with new sounds, very loud sounds. Why do humans do that? Is there a precedent in nature? Nothing in this world exists in isolation, and so it is with silence. It's not pure, pristine, or unspoiled. In the absence of external sounds, we hear the sounds of our hearing apparatus. Life isn't silent, not completely. Still, silence is healing for many people, and we can experience some of its benefits by simply shifting our focus. It reminds me of a Zen story about being in a rowboat on a foggy lake. Another rowboat appears through the fog and hits your boat. If the boat is empty, you simply push it away. But if the boat has people in it, you fight with them. Zen would have us see all interference as an empty rowboat. This would require a shift in focus. Join us today as we explore the pursuit of silence. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett, PhD.
Thank you, Lena. We're social animals. More so than other primates, our biology is highly adapted to live with and learn from other humans. We have innate capacities to cooperate, empathize, and imitate. These are capacities that emerge when we're children, that we develop in adolescence, and continue to develop as adults. Of course, this is very much in conflict with our dominant ideology of competition, material success, and possessive self-interest. Even pursuits in the realm of cooperation and empathy have been infected, so that we have social capital as a field of study and social entrepreneurship as an occupation. It is an ideology for a world of inequalities that are the inevitable result of differences in effort, skill, desire, effectiveness, and social position. Empathy and our other capacities as social beings enter as an afterthought, what we do after we've made sure we've got ours. It is now widely recognized in many disciplines that fairness is a fundamental human concern. However, the urge for fairness is one thing, what's fair in practice is quite another. It's something we have to learn. And of course, what's fair is deeply affected by the ideology that dominates us. So I was intrigued by the title of a recent article in Science magazine, Fairness and the Development of Inequality Acceptance. The research conducted in Norway engaged young people between the ages of 10 and 18 years in a game that had two parts. In the first part, each young person earned points by performing a set of tasks. In the second part, the young people were put into pairs and, using a method for assigning money values to the points, one person decided how much of the total the other person would get. On average, the person who decided how to split the earnings gave the other person about 45% of the total. If that surprises you, think about the dominant ideology and its effect on your expectations. The researchers also found that the older subjects were affected more strongly in their decision by their partner's success in earning points. The conclusion the researchers draw is that as adolescents mature, they weigh their sense of another person's success more heavily in deciding what's fair. Think of merit pay and the deserving poor. Where did these young people learn that they should weigh another person's success in deciding what's fair? To put it more plainly, why does someone who scores more points deserve more of the collective take? The answer is that in our culture, we're taught in very many ways from a very young age that more points means deserves more, and so it's fair that those with more get more. I emphasize here that this isn't about teaching values. It's about learning how the world works. It's about learning the rules of the game. Could it be otherwise? Yes. The psychologist Peter Gray has written about hunter-gatherer societies, their organization, how hunting and gathering are accomplished, and how children learn. His objective is to inform our own practices from the perspective of hunter-gatherer practices. After all, he observes, hunter-gatherer practices enabled humans to adapt and thrive in a wide variety of ecological niches over hundreds of thousands of years. With regard to how children learn, Dr. Gray observes that, for the most part, adults are not involved in children's education. Younger children learn from older children and from their own acts of exploration and discovery. When they want to know how adults do things, they hang around adults. This goes on until the late teens or early 20s, at which point the young people decide to join in hunting or gathering. The child's education has included both learning practical skills and social skills. His or her education has prepared the child to participate in an adult society that is radically egalitarian, where coercion is virtually unknown, where decision-making is by consensus, and where there is no inequality of power, although there are leaders and authorities whose social position has nothing to do with how many points they score. To our modern sensibilities, this sounds like complete anarchy, which I suppose it is. This is the educational system that enabled humans to succeed over most of our species' existence. It's an educational system to which we are biologically adapted. And if you think that such a system would be impossible today, think again. Dr. Gray discusses the Sudbury Valley School in Massachusetts as being like a hunter-gatherer band. There are no teachers, but there are 10 adult staff members. They serve as resources and authorities available for the students' self-directed learning needs. There are 200 students of mixed age. The older students work with the younger students. All students follow their noses in exploration and discovery. Staff member contracts are renewed each year by a vote of the students. The school has been in operation for 40 years. There are others in its network throughout the United States and the world. What does this have to do with your health? What's a fair way for people to get medical care? What's a fair way to protect people from physical and social exposures that might harm them? What's a fair way to make sure that each person has a good life? We learn the answers to these questions from a very young age. One version, the one that dominates us, is to be found through No Child Left Behind. The hunter-gatherer version, the one for which we are biologically adapted, will be found in places such as Sudbury Valley. A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is an environmental economist, writer, and health educator who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. Now to our topic for today, silence, and our guest, George Prochnik, Prochnik, is the author of Putnam Camp, Sigmund Freud, James Jackson Putnam, and the Purpose of American Psychology. His most recent essays have been published in the New York Times, Boston Globe, and Cabinet magazine. His new book, which we're discussing today, In Pursuit of Silence, Listening for Meaning in a World of Noise, is published by Doubleday. He lives in Brooklyn, New York. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Oh, such a pleasure. So do you think there have always been interior people who prefer silence and others who are exterior who like stimulation and noise? Has there always been sort of a shift like that, between a split?
I think unquestionably there have always been people who have a natural affinity for silence or for more external stimulation, and I certainly count myself among the former. But I also think that with that basic dichotomy in our tastes or our natural predilections, that there's something that's happened now where even for people who might have some draw towards noise naturally, things have so swung out of balance that many, many people feel just barraged all the time or too much of the time by too much loud sound.
Speaking of sound, I'm going to ask you to not speak directly into your mouthpiece because you've got one of those phones that causes your S's to become sort of poppy and hissy.
Sure.
So if you can sort of talk a little bit away. I have to say that one of the things that I learned reading the book is that when you really investigate a subject completely like this, you find out that it's not a straight line, that there's that everything is very, very complex, and things don't exist in isolation. Even silence isn't pure, as I said in the frame. And the other thing is how much of the pursuit of silence among people is, I think, probably tied to the luxury of money, or at least early exposure to quiet.
Right. Well, I think certainly recently we have a situation where quiet has been increasingly commodified, so that if you're someone with financial resources and actually even the cultural resources to know about the benefits of silence, usually there's some way that you can find it. Either you can take yourself off to a silent retreat somewhere, or you can purchase expensive soundproofing, or you can just manage to carve out the free time that would enable you to find a place in nature where you can really feel yourself immersed in something other than the noise that many people live with all the time. But the problem is, I see that sliver of people who have that the means to pursue kind of what I think of as boutique silence, it gets smaller and smaller relative to the larger and larger mass of people who don't have that luxury. And I think that one of the reasons that the world is as loud as it is that there are many people who at this point simply have no positive experiences of silence at all in their life, and who therefore don't even know that it might be something positive to aspire to.
I did a little workshop with a group, a nonprofit that was developed and run and is run by former foster kids who are adults, and it trains young former foster children who are now adults on how to work on help, you know, be social workers for other foster kids now. Mm-hmm. And the woman who was herself a foster kid, so these are people who had really a hard life. You know, this is hard time stuff. She asked me to speak on internalizing self-care. And unfortunately, I realized that a certain amount of quietude was essential for discovery of what it is that you need at any given moment, that I don't know any other way. So I only did a very brief thing, and it was very similar to your experience in the book of with some children, you know, in poverty, areas in poverty, talking about silence and how they equated it with people getting murdered and horrible experiences where people were sort of struck dumb by the experience, that it was all negative, that indeed when I asked this group to sit quietly for I think I did 10 minutes, and it was some of them actually did it. Some of them were able to do it, about half, and the other half couldn't do it at all, and some of them did other things like draw, and this was out in nature, and they were drawing in the sand and stuff, and it was fascinating to see what that was like for them and how foreign it was for them. These are people who are glued to their iPhones and stuff.
Right. Well, I know that for me, one of the most poignant experiences of the whole year in which I was doing this research was the experience that you referred to, where I went to a public school in a disadvantaged neighborhood where I knew one of the teachers, and he's someone who's an enormously commanding figure. He's 6'4", and he's an athlete and a real authority, person of authority who kids respect. And he was teaching in a high school, and he told me, I can't get these kids to be quiet for 1 minute, not 1 minute. And I simply didn't believe him. I thought this had to be an exaggeration. And to go to the school and then actually see him try this repeatedly in different contexts, in different ways, I was shocked. And subsequent to that, I went home and I asked him to go back to these kids. And I thought to myself, all right, he couldn't get them to do this in the school, but what was one moment of silence in their lives that they could talk about that maybe would be something that one might be able to build on to build a greater appreciation of what silence is about? So I asked him to ask each of his students to think of what had been one very powerful moment of silence. And when I came back into this 10 students and sat with them and started hearing their stories, as you said, the first person said to me, I remember when my father hit my mother, I didn't want to speak with anyone for a week. I remember when my brother was killed in a gang fight, I couldn't talk to anyone for a month. I was sent to therapy. And one after the other, every single one of these kids told a story in which the idea of silence was associated with anguish, with being silenced. They simply didn't have another way of thinking about it. And I think, really, when we try to imagine the lives of populations like this, and it's obviously not only something at this point that's in the inner city, it's also a phenomenon that exists in exurban communities, even suburban, even some rural communities where there's lots of heavy machinery and where you have homes full of entertainment devices. I think we're really in a situation where, for many people, the primary use that they're going to put to their own ability to control noise is going to be invariably to make more noise just as a way of blocking out that din which is invading them. Ironically, I think a lot of the discretionary noise that is part of our world of sound today is actually an effort at soundproofing on an individual level from this larger environmental cacophony in which so many of these kids who move from loud homes to loud streets to loud stores to loud restaurants to often loud schools, you know, it's no wonder really that they turn up their personal sound devices as loud as they do, because at least then it's noise that they've chosen.
Yeah, to comment on what you just said, two things. One is that for many people who are in really tough situations where there's a lot of invasion, both physical and emotional, if they have a quiet moment, it produces anxiety. I mean,
right.
there's fear that comes up in quietude because that's been sort of hanging around in there sometimes. So that's difficult too.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think it's an illegitimate fear. Absolute silence is really going to be death. It's the end of all vibration. It's really the end of organic being.
Well, and, or it creates a space
for
things to come up.
Right, but I'm saying if we literally take it in a technical sense, where if we think of noise as a factor of vibrating matter.
Oh, I
you know,
see.
So if you have none of that, you're in some kind of
you're
effect.
In a tomb. Yes.
You're in a tomb.
Never good.
Never good. And I think that you know, also because of our the cultural emphasis that we place on youth and these ideas of being forever young, immortality, that there is a particular register of associations with that kind of tomb silence, as you said, that's very frightening, and people don't know what to do with it in the lack of some larger religious framework that they can contextualize it.
Yeah, although we're talking about kids in nature with bird sounds and stuff, but still, you know, the silence of not having distraction. But the other thing is, as you pointed out, that people who are attracted to making the most noise, the ones who compete to make the most noise, you know, like the big truckers and the you know, the guys with the huge stereos and the boom cars, are often disadvantaged to some extent, both educationally and financially. Not always. Some people get into it for the gaming aspect, but most people aren't. And aren't advantaged. And what you see in a low socioeconomic strata is a lack of choice and power, and that's the most corrosive form of stress, is to feel helpless. So as you say, if you can make a bunch of noise, then you're making a choice.
I mean, that point, you know, that's a great point, and it opens up in so many different directions. You know, one person whose work really became important to me while I was writing the book was a turn-of-the-century anti-noise activist in Germany named Theodor Lessing, who started an anti-noise society there that had as its premise the idea that quiet is distinguished. And what he was really interested in trying to communicate to people was that form of distinction, these benefits of a more sensitive, more perceptually open relationship to the environment shouldn't just be the privilege of the wealthy elite. And he came at this from a point that I think is so important to the way that our world sounds today. When he was thinking about the kinds of noise that assaulted him, which he mentions, for example, a maid hanging out the bedding and sort of shaking the sheets, etc., or a drummer beating the drum, or a coachman cracking his whip, that all these ways of making noise he described as a means of magnifying their space of power. And if we think about the boom box, and, you know, in Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, or we think about boom cars driving through our neighborhoods today. I mean, clearly, this is, in at least on one level, a way of actually extending one's physical property, often among people who don't have so much property, through these waves of sound that then occupy the larger environment. So he tried to think of, and I think it's something that we really need to do today, to think of ways of kind of seducing people into understanding that there might be other forms of power worth cultivating, not just acoustical machismo, if you will, but also something that showed how much you could take in from the world around you, how much you could understand, which could only be experienced in a state of relative quiet.
And maybe creating situations where they can be heard without making noise. You're listening to your own health and fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We're interviewing George Prochnik, P-R-O-C-H-N-I-K. His book, In Pursuit of Silence, Listening for Meaning in a World of Noise. Well, you went to one of the points I wanted to make, which is that our obsession with quiet isn't modern. Some people wax poetic for the good old days, and the good old days were extremely noisy. I mean, we forget that there were there were people yelling out their things for sale on the street. There was the clattering of carriages, and I mean, it was enormously noisy in post-industrial or beginning of industrial cities.
Right.
Very noisy.
And in fact, at least for some people, it could be even louder than our cities today, in the sense that if you were living in late Victorian London, you might well, if you were not economically well-to-do, you might be living close to some form of heavy manufacturing. There was very little zoning, and we have definitely spared ourselves some of those larger noises by limiting the places where large factories, etc., operate. But at the same time, I mean, this really was at the heart of one of the things I came to feel when I was looking at these cities in the past, and it all starts getting loud in the Industrial Revolution. But in fact, we can go back to ancient Rome and see Julius Caesar had to make special laws about when people could bring goods into the city, when the chariots could come in, so as not to disturb the sleep. Noise in cities, noise in civilization have always gone together, and I asked myself, well then, you know, is it really true that the world today is noisier? And what I came to feel was that we can't say that the world today is noisier, but paradoxically, I think we can say that there is less silence, by which I mean that if we take that Victorian city, or certainly back in ancient Rome, we had urban environments in which there was greater acoustical contrast, meaning there was not the same levels of just constant ambient noise everywhere they went. There wasn't a big roadway with heavy traffic going by. There weren't all of the stores all of the time playing music, all of the restaurants. There were more places to escape the noise for at least a little bit and kind of recharge on all the different things that quiet can present to us. I think now, for many people, there really aren't any of these oases left, and that's one of the reasons that there's such a sense of being besieged, invaded, vulnerable to the sound. What you brought up the issue of control, and many of the studies that look at how noise affects us tie the degree of exacerbation and the degree of, mm-hmm. of pain it causes to a sense of control.
Mm-hmm.
There was a fascinating study done just a few years ago in Sweden that took place in a very noisy neighborhood. There were two lines of apartment buildings. One of them had a quiet rear side, and the others didn't. So there was a sort of common courtyard that people could go out into. And the people on this who had that place where they knew they could get away to reported a 50% less general sense of annoyance due to environmental noise pollution than they did on the other side. Just that much, just even a not that pleasant urban courtyard, to just feel you could go somewhere and get some space from that silence made an enormous difference in their psychological health.
Yes, helplessness is, as I said, in all animal studies that were done, is the most corrosive form of stress. It causes the most health problems. And it's interesting that barking dogs and loud music is a universal irritant. As I found out yesterday trying to read your book, when, although I am in the woods, the weather has been nice and everybody's dogs are out, and they were just going guns, you know, and I kept trying to shift my focus, do the rowboat thing, you know, don't, it's just a dog, it's going to stop, you know, identify with the dog. You know, I tried everything, and even in trying made myself even more insane. So it turns out that, you know, this concern that we have about sound, and I should say that although ancient cities were noisy, we have only recently begun to have the capacity to use technology to make sounds that could actually explode the planet. So, and people are using them in their individual headsets, and they're also, you know, I mean, it's all over the place. I was absolutely shocked when you started talking about the sound manipulation that Harley motorcycles, which we also have a lot of when the weather gets nice. I almost hate to have the weather get nice out here. Suddenly there are Harleys on the roads down there. That they're actually modulated, that isn't how loud they would really like to be. That's because you stop and you think, okay, cars have mufflers. You can see how I feel about this. Cars have mufflers. Why are these motor, you know, but they're actually muffled a little.
Well, you know, you may also be in a case where, although legally Harley has retooled its machines so that they're not as loud as they used to be, mm-hmm. many people strip away these legal sound mitigation mm-hmm. efforts. You know, I mean, that really.
Ooh, if thoughts could kill.
you know, that's another thing. I think we're really caught in terms of our ability ultimately to legally make great headway against noise, because there's so many ways of circumventing the laws, and there's so little money or attention mm-hmm. to enforcement mm-hmm. that it's another reason, just to go back to the point that we were discussing at the beginning, that I really came to hope that we would find ways of instilling in people a desire on the parts of even Harley drivers to understand that there might be something in silence for them. Because I think unless we get a stronger sense of aspiration towards it, we're going to really have a hard time making much difference in what happens. I mean, the noise that you described being tormented by when you were outside yesterday, the barking dogs, I mean, again, this is, we're never going to do much legally with that, and yet it's a constant. I mean, I think in England, it's, if I remember correctly, it's the number one noise complaint is those barking dogs.
Okay, another place
neighbors.
Not to move. No, we started thinking, you know, okay, somewhere in the desert in the Southwest, there must be a quiet spot. We have just a couple of minutes before I take a brief break, but the thing is that noise actually does harm to our health. I mean, we're discussing the sense of helplessness and the anxiety and anger that it causes in the fights between people and deaths, actually, where people even shoot each other over noise. But it has a profound effect on our health. There are many studies, we've done shows on this before, that show that it has a profound effect on cardiovascular health.
Well, the most really devastating evidence that I saw about the specific physiological effects of noise were some of the recent research related to some of the recent research that's been done in Europe, very, very rigorous studies on air traffic and health. And these studies, which looked at the effects of jet traffic noise on even subjects who remained asleep, even if people
mm-hmm.
could
that's
habituate themselves exactly enough that they weren't woken by the noise, still blood pressure elevates, heart rate goes up, stress hormones are released, there's vasoconstriction. And what's most disturbing is that these consequences of the noise persist throughout the day, even if the people then go on to work in a relatively quiet environment.
Yeah, interrupted sleep is murder, even if you don't think you're interrupted, as you say.
Right. And so, yes, this issue of cardiovascular health, I mean, in the developing world, there was one person I spoke with who was affiliated with the WHO, who said that he felt that there were up to 40,000 noise-related heart attacks, fatal heart attacks, a year in the developing world alone, due to primarily these very loud power generators that you have in many locations. So I think that the evidence for these effects on our physical health that go well beyond our auditory perceptions is just becoming more and more unavoidably convincing.
We're going to take just a brief break, about a 30-second break, and we'll come back to this conversation with George Prochnik, P-R-O-C-H-N-I-K, author of In Pursuit of Silence, Listening for Meaning in a World of Noise. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, Ph.D., and this is Your Own Health and Fitness. Please stay with us. We'll be back shortly. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, Ph.D., and we're on the phone with George Prochnik, P-R-O-C-H-N-I-K, In Pursuit of Silence, Listening for Meaning in a World of Noise. If you missed parts of today's show, you can get information about Your Own Health and Fitness, including our guests, our practice, and a free stream of this week's show. Our archive, CD copies, our book. There's lots more there at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number, 707-874-2772, and you can email us at admin, A-D-M-I-N, at yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out. And, George, you have a website for the book. Is it just inpursuitofsilence.com?
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay, so one of the most profound things that's not so good, as my grandfather used to say, it's not so good about all this noise, is the effect on infants and the developing brain and language. I mean, we've got video games where I've read other research where there's noise and lights and things, and versus sitting and looking at a painting, there's that. And then there's just language and autism and the developing brain and infants with loud noises. I mean, there are people who write about how to prevent infants from getting crazy on you, and they advise using white noise machines. And this is the first time it was in your book that I heard that that might not be good. I mean, the argument is that it's very noisy in the womb. There's squishing sounds, loud squishing noises and stuff, and so that kind of does that. But you have a very interesting perspective on the developing brain and noise.
Well, I think there is increasing evidence that any form of constant background noise, when you have a very young child in the house who is still in the process of developing language, can be dangerous and sometimes very disturbingly detrimental to the language acquisition process. I spoke, and one of the people that I interviewed was Michael Merzenich, who is a pioneer of brain plasticity, and he was concerned about white noise machines a number of years ago, in the same way that he was concerned about people who put on in their homes next to their infant's crib a loud fan or air conditioner or music source as a way of, say, again, soundproofing the child from some kind of external noise, maybe a street or maybe other noise in the house. And what he described to me, the problem he articulated is if you have a situation where the child always has that one stream of noise going into the brain at the same time as they're trying to learn language, the ways that the brain hooks up the auditory cortex, makes its connections, is going to also be wired for the noise. The child's brain isn't going to be able to distinguish between relevant and irrelevant noise. So he used this term of the brain can become wired for noise. And he described the process of language acquisition in that kind of an environment as what it would be like to be raised by a single parent with a cleft palate. And he said in that situation, the child wouldn't be learning English. Excuse me, they'd be learning noisy English. And I I know that with white noise machines, that one of the things that I've been aware of is that if you look at the advertising, and in fact, if you Google white noise machines in children, you'll actually come up with many sites indicating white noise machines are good for children's health, good for children's neurological health. And if you actually dig a little deeper, you'll see that many of these are promotional articles by the white noise machine manufacturers talking about the ability to help with sleep, and I think really trying to get away from some of these more disturbing possibilities of what that constant band of noise can be. But I think it's something that parents really should watch and try to limit as much as possible.
Yeah. No, I thought that was fascinating. I never considered. I don't have children, thank God, but because they're noisy.
they are noisy, but you know, I think it's also just part of a larger shift whereby children are receiving such an overdose of stimulation from their environment that, you know, there are now many, many toys that are sold largely on the basis of the noise they make, and some of these are extraordinarily
bad. The decibels are way above what you're supposed to be listening to.
You know, I was shown, when I was learning about this subject, I was shown a Tickle Me Elmo doll,
which sounds
reasonably educational, and it was loud enough that it was the equivalent of tickling a snowmobile. And, you know, you think about the effect of this. On these kids whose auditory system.
Well, that's another
so much
danger. I mean, you wouldn't want a kid to go up to a snow machine tickle it.
No, there's all sorts of problems that I think one wants to watch out for. But you know, I also did something interesting where I was at a friend's house who had small children, and they had on Sesame Street, an educational television, something that people look on as probably one of the better shows out there. And it just struck me as being so pumped up, so fast-cutting, so loud visually, loud sonically, just so much stimulation. And I went back, and I actually rented the very first Sesame Street.
It wasn't that way.
Ever made. No, it was like, compared to this, it was like watching Sesame Street on Quaaludes. But I say that in a good way. I mean, it was just slowed down to a human scale. You know, the children who were in this initial original show were exploring a construction environment. And, you know, there was plenty of stimulation, but it was all happening at the rate that children, that human beings actually interact with their environment. And I thought, going back and forth between the two, I thought, how could children today not be have attention disorder of different sorts? I mean,
oh yeah, you bet.
It's just, it's inevitable.
Oh yeah. Oh no, there's no. To medicalize these symptoms from childhood that are, even in a reasonably quiet environment, it's possible for young boys to be sort of hyperactive and to have that kind of attention all over the place kind of thing. I mean, and it's built into our marketing strategies.
Very much.
I want to go to that, but before we go to that, just briefly, well, maybe we should go to that first. I'll just save the other question. I wanted to talk a little bit about the organs, the origins in nature for our noise making, but we're on a kind of a trajectory. Yeah, well, sound, you know, manipulates us, as you're just pointing out with the kids. And I mean, one of the reasons that we've been covering we've been very concerned about the explosion of wireless microwave band technologies, because we started looking into it 12 years ago and started, interviewing all these researchers from all over the globe. And the science is not good on this. Even though it's non-ionizing radiation, so its damage is not the same. It actually is the same by a different mechanism, so it's damaging DNA, and it's causing, you know, these brain tumors. No kidding at all about this. The Interpol study that just came out is just really, it's one of those studies where if you read the study, you can see that it's saying there's an association, and it's very prerogative, and then if you read the conclusions, it says something different. You can just see the money under the table, you know, going, here, take this. Or, you know, it wouldn't be so healthy for you to report on that. You might have, like, very heavy shoes. Incidentally, I'm from Brooklyn. But not when it was the way it is where it is now. It was very Jewish when I was there. So, and it was somewhat noisy, I have to say. In fact, I have a funny story. I went back to visit my uncle when I was in my 30s, and I was lying on a bed trying to take a nap in Brooklyn. and I was listening out. It was warm. It was summer, and I was listening to the sounds of children playing outside, and I got very sort of into this reverie of remembering being very little in Brooklyn and the sounds of kids out playing and yelling and stuff. Suddenly I heard this window go up, and a woman yelled, "Hey, come here, pick your head for you." And I went, "Oh, Brooklyn, yes. Childhood, yes." That tells you even more than you wanted to know about my childhood. But no. My parents were educated. But sound. The reason that I'm concerned about the technologies is because they overstimulate people. That's one of the side effects, is hyperarousal. It really does cause hyperarousal. People's blood pressure goes up. Their heart rates go up.
If I can interject one thing also that I'm certain we're going to see somebody doing research on soon, if it isn't already happening. And let me back into this by coming back to the question of attention deficit disorder and ADHD syndromes. We know that, a bit paradoxically, that for at least some children with attention deficit problems, in fact, a certain level of background noise, constant background noise, can be beneficial to the ability to concentrate. And there are different studies looking into why this might be the case, but one of the most convincing that I've seen is that many children with this problem, or perhaps all of them, are identified also to have low levels of dopamine. And the noise increases the dopamine release. Now, that's one level of studies. I also saw a fascinating study that was done on a group of rats who were administered low doses of ecstasy, MDMA.
Oh, yes.
And they divided this group of rats into two. One half of them were given the drug in a quiet laboratory setting, and the other half were given it in a setting where the sound level was that of a typical discotheque. The rats who were given the ecstasy in the quiet setting, their brains straightened out from the drug in less than 24 hours. The ones who were given it in the noisy environment, it took a full 5 days for their electrocortical parameters to get back to something like rat normal. And the implication was that the toxicity of the drug had been dramatically increased by the admixture of noise, and one of the things that was caused because of the noise was a much greater flood of dopamine release, which is something the drug already did. So I think that in terms of this hyperarousal, we're going to find that really noise probably releases dopamine in all of us, whether or not we have attention disorder problems and whether or not we're taking ecstasy, that noise simply chemically arouses our system, apart even from the sheer effect of those deep vibrations going into our skeletal frame. There may be different kinds of releases, chemical releases in our bodies that overstimulate us. And that one may be one reason also that I think we have the problem that we do now, grappling with the noise problem, because I feel that if we look around, there is clearly, although many, many people, I know if I were to stop many people on the streets here in New York City and ask them about things that bothered them about life in New York, many people would rank noise relatively high on the list. But in a lot of cases, those are the same people who, after saying, "It's all the noise," put back on their MP3 player and crank up their tunes, whatever they are. They get in a car, they turn on the radio, they come home, they turn on a background television. There is this clandestine love affair with noise.
Well, it's being marketed into us. I mean, there is a dovetail. The marketing of wireless devices, which I understand the attraction. I have no trouble understanding the attraction. It's just I've read the science, so I'm not indulging. Mm. But they are designed a specific way. And I would posit that we've got another cigarette situation here, in the sense that the product is designed to stimulate the dopamine receptors. We know that this is true. There's research that shows this in the same way. And it's interesting because noise and wireless radiation, microwave radiation, are changing our native environment in a way that we're not evolved to handle. I mean, there's an area where you talk about that.
I think that's really well put. You know, I saw an article recently talking about these different laboratories where they are manufacturing foods that have an intense...
I just did a show on it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say quickly that, you know, there are these configurations of salt, fat, and sugar that can make you incredibly hungry, even if you're not. And there's a specific term that one person coined for these foods, hyperpalatable foods.
Yeah, this is David Kessler.
David Kessler, right. Correct.
We just interviewed him, yeah.
Well, and so I think, you know, we have hyperpalatable sounds.
That's right.
And that these sounds are ones that make us crave more noise, even when essentially they're exhausting exhausting us because of the releases of dopamine and everything else. They're actually putting incredible stress on our systems. You know, there's one more rat study, if you can bear with me, that I think of in this context that I think is extremely germane. It was done in the 1950s and was so surprising. It was something done in Tokyo where scientists divided, again, a group of rats into two, and they raised one group of rats in a quiet laboratory setting, and the other group they raised beneath an elevated train that had more than 1,200 passages a day. And they had all sorts of hypotheses about what would happen to the rats raised in noise. They thought they would be more aggressive. They thought that they would be basically nervous wrecks, and that the rats raised in silence wouldn't be. And they found, indeed, this was true. The rats raised in noise were not only more aggressive, they also had much poor nutrition. They didn't eat right. They had lower fertility rates, all sorts of problems. But they also lived 53 days longer than the rats raised in quiet. So there's a paradox there. And they repeated the experiment several times and got the same results in different kinds of loud environments and different kinds of quiet environments. Clearly, that stimulation in some way can keep us going, just like the release of adrenaline, but at what cost? I mean, the rats had miserable rat lives, but clearly their systems had also been spiked by that dose of stimulation.
Yeah, you can also starve animals and get them to live a long time, but they can't reproduce. So
I think it's a good
point. But if you do that to human beings, then you've got these consumers that are. I mean, I could go on such a trajectory. The point is that we're being marketed to in a very manipulative way, and it's very thought through. I just want to say this is your own health and fitness. I'm Lena Berman. We're interviewing George Prochnik. I keep hesitating with that. Prochnik, Prochnik, which is when you add Nick to the end of a word in Yiddish, it means it's a person. Like a nudnik is an irritating person. Nick is the person part. So I have to think you're a proch person.
I'm afraid so.
You're a proch, whatever proch is.
I think it's stone.
Stone Nick. You're a stony person. You are. You're man. You're just. I'm flashing here. In pursuit of silence, listening for meaning in a world of noise. Yeah, I mean, you examined, put yourself in all these situations where noise is used, sound, music is being used as manipulation for people to buy things. But, you know, then you go back to Hitler, which was he was the first real sound engineer.
Well, David Bowie.
March.
A line about that. David Bowie said Hitler was the first rock star. His ability to create these extraordinary noise and visual spectacles to mesmerize his audiences was hypnotic in a way no one had manipulated crowds before him. But I was fascinated to find that when Hitler was really coming to power in the 1930s, and people around the world were trying to understand what it was that had made this guy who so many people found reprehensible and etc. to be such a charismatic figure. There was someone, an American professor, who analyzed his voice and found that Hitler's voice, he said, actually vibrated 228 times a second when he was angry relative to what a normal person's 220 times a second. And he said that this was enough of a difference to make the effect of Hitler's voice like being stunned by an automobile horn, that it kept his listeners in a captivated sort of head-blocked state of submissive, basically of malleability. And certainly it was the case that the Third Reich was incredibly careful about Hitler's voice, and to the point that they actually had a voice double, someone whose name was Adolf Wagner, whose sole function was to be able to replicate Hitler's voice exactly, all of its rises and falls, its different rhythms and gutturals, if whenever he had a vocal problem. And in fact, he periodically did have these polyps, etc., that the New York Times, I found these very long articles, feature stories, whenever Hitler had a little problem with his voice. There does seem to have been something that the world recognized as enormously magnetic about it and dangerous. And you know, after I read this, I spoke with a neuroscientist who's looking at some of the ways that certain kinds of noise can trigger aggression, and he's looking at the ways that actually certain baby cries, unfortunately, have put them and may be contributing. The sound of their cries may be contributing to the kind of rage that in an unhinged individual leads to abuse. And he talked to me about the ways that when you stress a voice in certain ways, we can hear it as a dangerous dissonance, that it affects us apart from any associations with what's being said, that it hits a particularly vulnerable part of our auditory cortex. And I began speaking with him about this, and then I was reading more reports of what people experienced when they were listening to Hitler speak. And people described consistently how he would begin in this raspy voice, and then he would drop to a pleasant baritone, and then he would rise up. So in fact, there were all of these harmonic changes, many of which were clearly stressing his voice. And we may be set up to respond to certain sort of anti-harmonics, certain wrong clusters of frequencies, with a sense of almost our worlds being disrupted and of something unsettling that can incite anger in us. And Hitler was able to channel that anger, obviously, to enormously disastrous effect. And when it's the case in the environment around us, it may leave lots of us feeling a kind of rage that we don't know what to do with or even exactly what's producing it, but just feel ourselves whipped up.
Oh, no, it's clearly being used by certain elements of the extreme right. I called, when I was going to get into this topic with you, I have written how sounds are used to manipulate us from shopping to invading Poland. Mm. So, but what we find now is that, and we've got about more like about 7 or 8 minutes, so I just want to give you a sense, because there's a few things I wanted to touch on, and that is that there's sound manipulation built into products and into shopping environments. Maybe that's enough to say right there, but in other words, corporations are spending a lot of money to understand how sound manipulates shoppers and people in work environments, and it goes way back.
It goes all the way back to really the beginning of music, where, for the first time in the 1930s, there was a company, a longshoreman's company in New York City, that made some kind of a contract with Muzak to begin piping in sound to the workers. And from the beginning, what Muzak did was they didn't just try to pump workers up all the time. They tried to create a rhythm of labor to the day, where they'd sort of get, create a kind of music, stream in a music that would get people working really hard and then give them a little respite and then build it back up. And there was this sort of rolling wave of the way people were made to rivet to rhythm was this one expression that was used. And in fact, it proved immediately so effective on the workers, who all reported liking it, but that the unions rebelled against it and felt that the workers were being brought to produce more than they were obligated to produce, and that they were essentially being artificially drugged into working harder than they were than they ought to have been. And Muzak was taken out for a while, but this happened shortly before the outbreak of the Second World War. And once there was that incredible demand on production brought by the war, all of those objections to using music in terms of labor were dropped. And we can then chart a really steady increase in the use of very calculated musical programs into all sorts of different working environments throughout the 40s, the 50s.
And to now, where really sophisticated sound engineers are actually working for corporations to create a specific effect on consumers in restaurants and buying environments, shopping.
This works in every kind of environment, and I mean, just to say a word about restaurants, I mean, there what's interesting is I think there were a convergence of two trends happen, and you can actually chart when it started. The first news reports on restaurants being aggressively noised on purpose are at the beginning of the 1980s, another wonderful product of the Reagan administration in that era of spectacle. And you start to have critics saying, here's this hot new restaurant, and they're intentionally making it loud. And, I know that in New York City, Café Luxembourg, a well-known restaurant, was one of the first that did that. And they interviewed the restaurateurs, and they spoke of wanting for the first time to make a space that would be somehow consistent with the sound levels of a party, of a disco, to create a high-energy, super-vibrant atmosphere where there wouldn't be any more privileging of conversation. But instead of that, what people would feel would be a sense that they were really at some sort of an event. And at the same time, as there began to be a very careful choice about the nature of the environment, the interior decorators, I think separately, but it all converged, began stripping away all of the tablecloths and napkins and all curtains and making these hard body acoustical spaces that would bounce the sound around. And the two together set us up for the sort of acoustical environment we have in restaurants today where, you know, a trendy restaurant is often considered dead unless it is really, really loud. And I think as a whole, as a society, what we see in that is a perfect microcosm of this tilt away from values of intimacy towards ecstasy, towards a sort of orgiastic
arousal.
Yeah,
hyper-arousal. And also eat fast and get out and more people come in. We're very much running out of time. I just want to mention very quickly that acoustic neuromas are not just from cell phones anymore. Sound will do that. You will go deaf if you play your MP3 player loud enough for people to hear it outside. You will go deaf.
That's right. That's right. And anytime you can hear that, I was told by the head of cochlear implant surgery at NYU, anytime you can hear someone's personal sound device, they're bumping off hair cells.
Right. And there's much information in the book we're not getting to about all kinds of interesting things about deaf people and how they see the world, and also about boom cars and what sound waves can do when they get up to 180 decibels, where they can actually blow things up and windows smash and people's hair blows up in the air and all kinds of things, which is dangerous, actually. Let's talk. We only have about 2 or 3 minutes. Let's talk about some of the good news and also some of the secret quiet places in cities, and also what you want to see in terms of teaching silence in the school and things like that.
Well, to come at that quickly, basically, I think that we have to start expanding our notion of what silence is and of how we can create it. And while it's very important that those of us who have the knowledge and resources go off on whatever silent retreats we can, I think we have to look at this as a broader societal problem at this point. And therefore, in the curricula of the schools, instead of just warning kids about the danger of noise, which has a way of being shut off by children, I think, who already feel besieged by warnings about the toxins in their environment, we have to also start teaching some of the benefits that we're learning about what silence can bring, whether in terms of the different kinds of studies that have been done on concentration and increases in overall ability to function effectively through silent meditation, or in terms of empathy with other human beings. There's a whole roster of different positive effects of silence that we're learning about, and I'd love to see those introduced into the school systems. And I also think that we really have to make an effort to create spaces where silence can be made democratically accessible, since we're not going to ever, I think, or at least in the foreseeable future, get too far with trying to lower the volume level of large geographical areas. Maybe what we should be doing instead is trying to create little oases where people can get away from the din, the kind of thing that used to exist in those cities 150 years ago, even when they were quite loud. And one of the most beautiful enactments of this in New York City are these parks known as pocket parks that began to be built in the 1960s, where vacant lots and buildings that were condemned and were torn down were converted into these very small parks that were planted beautifully with foliage that often had acoustically absorbent properties. There would be a water feature, a waterfall that would also help to block the noise of the streets. There would be different sorts of trees that would attract birds so that you would get bird song. And these spaces, which are really very economical, are extremely good and were recognized from their inception as enormous.
Yeah.
Enormous enhancements of the urban fabric that really allowed people to get a lot of what silence can offer, even in those bigger injections.
We got to let it go there. I've only got about 30 seconds to close out the show. So sorry to let you go. George Prochnik, In Pursuit of Silence. Thank you so much. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. There's information about Your Own Health and Fitness at yourownhealthandfitness.org. You can also listen to a free stream of today's show. That you can also reach us by email at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Jeffrey Fawcett, PhD. And remember, being informed not only protects your health, It protects your freedom.